Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games, and today we are talking about a board game.
Yes.
Like we like to do, like we are known to do.
Like we are one to do.
So, Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We're talking about Welcome To, designed by Benoit Turpin and published by Blue Cocker Games in 2018. It was nominated for a lot of awards, including several Golden Geek categories.
I guess it is called Welcome To ... On the cover, they add your perfect home. But
in Board Game Geek, it's just listed as Welcome To ...
Welcome To ... Okay.
Now, the spinoff, Welcome To Las Vegas, has a proper subtitle, but not the original.
Interesting. All right, so Welcome To ... is a roll and write game of sorts. For a short description on what it's about, in Welcome To, players are suburban city planners attempting to make the best estates by strategically placing houses and taking actions. At the beginning of each turn, players write pairs of randomly drawn numbers and taking their respective actions into their own suburb sheet. At the end of the game, players tally how many points they earned from completed estates, completed objectives, and their pools, parks, and temps. The player whose suburb scores the most points wins. So it's a very short description. Essentially, you use decks of cards to create pairs of numbers and actions. I should say every pair is one number and one action. And then players choose which of three different pairs to add to their town. Players take this action simultaneously, drawing from the same three pairs, so there's chances that players will take similar actions to each other or different ones. And then when the game ends, you tally points, and the player who earned the most points wins. So let's get a little bit more detailed into how the setup works and how play works. Then we'll get into strategy, and then later on we'll talk about design.
Yes.
So, setup. First off, there are these cards in this game. It's a pretty important component to understand, and it's one of only two... No, I'll take it back. Three components in this game that you need to know about. So the cards have two sides. On one side is a number, and on the back side is one of six actions. And we'll go into what those actions do later. But you take these cards, you shuffle them, and deal them into three equally sized decks. I think of like 27 cards is how many each deck will have. And then at the start of every turn, you take the top card of the deck and flip it over beside the deck that it was drawn from, which will do two things. It'll reveal the next card in the deck, and you place these cards number side up, so you'll see the number on the top of the deck, and then the card that you just flipped will have an action on the back. So you create three pairs from these three decks using the top card number on the deck and the reverse side of the card you just flipped over, which has the action. So you do this with each deck at the beginning of every turn to create three pairs. And then each player on their own chooses one of these pairs. Each player must write the number of the pair that they chose into their suburb, which is on a player sheet, which we'll describe in a second. And then they optionally may take the action tied to that number, paired with that number. So, Matthew, can you give a description of what the player sheets look like?
Right. So the main sort of feature is a set of three rows of houses. These are a row of 10 houses, a row of 11 houses, and a row of 12 houses. These have like a little fence surrounding them. There's a little street going between them. And in general, it looks like sort of a bird's eye view of a subdivision.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the houses have like pools in the backyard. And some of them have... Some of them have pools in the backyard. And then beneath the sort of subdivisions and the rows of houses is like a bunch of scoring bubbles.
Mm-hmm. It's like an array of score trackers.
Right. There is also a set of little score trackers on each row of houses. And we'll get to those in a second.
Mm-hmm. So the important thing to know is there's 10 houses in the top row, 11 in the middle row, 12 in the bottom row. They're blank. They don't have any numbers written on them. And there's fences that are on the far ends of each row, on the far left side of the leftmost house, the far right side of the rightmost house. And there's pools and there's some trackers dispersed among them. Okay, right. So those are the houses. Let's talk about, the last component are called the city plan cards, which are three major objectives that players are attempting to fulfill.
Yes.
So let's talk about how to place numbers in your houses.
Right.
So the numbers in the deck go from 1 to 15. They're distributed in a sort of bell curve fashion. So the cards in the middle, the numbers in the middle, 8, I think, is dead center, appear more often than the cards towards the outside. So there's not so many cards that have 15 or 1 on them. But the closer you get to the center of that array of numbers, the more of that number there appears in the decks.
Right. Specifically, 1, 2, 14, and 15 each have 2 copies. And then for each number inward on either side, it increases by 1 copy.
Okay. Less of a bell curve and more of a pyramid.
Sure.
Okay, so when at the start of the round, like I said, you make those three pairs, and then each player must choose a number and its corresponding action. When you write that number into your... So you can put it in any house you want, except you must arrange all numbers in a row in ascending order from left to right. So your lower numbers have to be towards the left side of your suburb, your higher numbers have to be towards the right side, and you cannot place houses out of order. But you can skip spaces, and you can skip numbers when placing houses next to one another. So, for example, you can put a house number of 15 directly next to a house number of 8. That's fine. You could also choose to put 8 somewhere in the middle of a row and put 15 all the way on one end of the row, leaving a number of houses in between them blank, and then you can fill those later. But when you do fill those later, you have to keep in mind that those numbers need to be between 8 and 15 now that you have started this ascending order. But you can put houses anywhere on the row, as long as you follow the ascending order rule.
Yes.
So you have to put the house number in. If you cannot put it in because there's nowhere to go, for example, if you already have a 7 and an 8 or in all three of your rows, and then you're trying to write another 8 in, you can't do it because you can't put two of the same number. They have to ascend. That's another rule, I guess. You can't put two of the same number. In that case, if you cannot place the number, then there are three sort of penalty boxes that you have to check off once per, you know, occasion that you can't place a house. If you ever check off your third penalty box, that is one of the ways that the game ends.
Yes.
And we'll might as well talk about the other two ways, which are filling up all three rows of houses on your board. If one player does that, then the whole game ends. And then the other is satisfying all three objectives for the city plan cards, all three city plan card objectives.
Yes. I think we should talk about the city planning next.
Sure.
So the way these work, as you place numbers on your rows of houses, you'll notice that there are also the fences on either side of those houses. You are able to place more fences using actions. And when you surround a group of houses that all have numbers with a fence, then that becomes an estate, which is just a collection of houses that are all filled in, surrounded by fences on either side. The building or the city plans cards require you to have specific estates of specific sizes. And once any player has reached that number of estates, they fill in those fences showing that they have completed those estates, and then they get points based on which permit they got. And what's important to note is that the first player to get a permit will get more points than every other player to get that same permit. So you want to be the first to get it because you'll usually earn like 4 or 5 more points than if you wait and somebody else gets it.
So there's three decks of city plan cards labeled number 1, number 2, number 3. And at the beginning of every game, when you're setting the game up, you randomly draw one of these city plan cards from each deck. So there will be always a total of 3 city plan cards, objectives to attempt to score. And each of these cards will have a higher number for the players that finish it first and a lower number for players that finish it later in the game.
Yes.
Both are visible on the front side of the card, but once one player, at least one player, has completed a city plan card, you flip it over, and the reverse side only has the lower number to show that that's the only point value that can be scored for the rest of the game from that city plan card.
Yeah. The estate sizes range from 1 to 6. Which means that you'll need varying groups of 1 to 6 houses that are covered, like I said, by 2 fences on either side.
Sure. So, for example, a city plan card might require an estate size of 6 and then 2 estate size of 1. So in order to accomplish that, you need to have 6 houses in a row in ascending order with a fence on either side. Again, the ends of a row already have a fence, so you could use that, or you could, again, take the fence actions throughout the game to place new fences in between houses to segment, you know, your 12, 11, or 10 rows of houses into smaller subsections of estates. You have to do the same thing with 1, but a 1 estate is much easier to create because you don't have to place anything in ascending order within the estate necessarily. You just have to block out 1 house. Now, I should mention, even when you subdivide a row of houses into smaller estates, they still have to be in ascending order from the far left to the far right of the row, no matter how many estates there are. The estates don't chop up the ascending order rule.
Right.
It applies to all houses in a row.
Right. So if you have 1 through 6 on a row all in a line, then the next one after the 6 has to be higher than 6, even if there's a fence there.
Yeah, even if you put a fence and start a new estate, the new estate has to start at 7 or higher.
Right.
So one city plan card might require like an estate size of 6 and 2 estate size of 1. Another city plan card might require an estate size of 6 plus another estate with the size of 4. So when you complete one of those city plan cards, you mark off the fence in a special way, you know, however you deem you want to mark it off. But you mark off the fence. I think they suggest marking it along the top of the row of houses, like behind the backyard, to show that you used that estate for that city plan card. So if I was planning to do the 6 and 2 ones and also the 6 and 4, and I completed the 6 and 2 ones first, I would mark off the tops of those 3 estates and write down the points for finishing the 6 and 2 ones estate. I need to build another estate of 6 houses to complete the 6 and 4. You cannot use the same estate for 2 different city plan objectives. So you mark them off to note that. Okay, let's talk about the actions in this game.
Yes.
So like we mentioned, there's a deck of cards. They have numbers on one side, and then the other side will have 1 of 6 actions on any given card. So the actions are as follows. There is the temp agency, which allows you to modify the number on the card it's paired with by 0, 1, or 2. So you can use the same number that's written on the card, or you can increase it or decrease it by 1 or 2 in any direction, increase or decrease. You can use this to decrease a card value down to 0 or increase a card value up to 17, since 15 is the highest number printed on a card, and this allows you to add up to 2 to it. So that is allowed. You can't go negative. That's important to note. So when you take the temp agency action, you choose how much you want to increase or decrease the value of the card before you write it in. And then after you write it in, whether you increased, decreased, or kept the number the same, you check off one of the temp agency boxes on the lower portion of your player sheet. And at the end of the game, you will score points if you have the most boxes checked off or the second or third most boxes checked off.
Right. And these are like, I think it's 7 points, 4 points, and 1 point.
Yes. Okay. Next action. Oh, yeah. Temp agency is
represented.
Represented by an orange like caution barrier.
Yeah, like what you'd see in road work.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Surveyor is the next one. The surveyor allows you to build a fence. It's represented by a white picket fence. So whenever you take this action, you can just draw in a dotted line between any 2 houses on your board, and it does not have to be next to the house that you just built with the number associated with this action.
It doesn't even have to be on the same row.
The house with the number associated with the action, and then you can put the fence wherever you want. Biz is signified by a pink mailbox with the word biz written on the side of it, B-I-S. Bis, I guess. when you take this action, you can duplicate any one of your houses into the house next to it, but you have to write the word biz underneath the house that you have created by this duplication. This allows you to fill in gaps that are hard to fill. So, for example, if you have a 7 and an 8, but there's a space in between them. Technically, that space is impossible to fill because you can't put another 7 or 8 unless you take the biz action, which allows you to duplicate one of those two numbers into the house next to it. The biz action is important to note. It doesn't have to be used on the house that you created this turn, but it can. And after you take the biz action, you have to check off the lowest value biz number on the biz tracker on the lower portion of your player sheet. And these are negative points against you at the end of the game.
Yes. If you use biz, you'll get a point penalty.
Yes. Okay, the next action is real estate agent, which is symbolized by a purple arrow and stacks of coins. The real estate agent will change how many points your estates earn you at the end of the game of any given size. So at the start of the game, your estates are worth 1 point per house in them. So like an estate size of 1 is worth 1 point, an estate size of 4 is worth 4 points, so on and so forth. But when you take the real estate agent action, you get to increase this value. So you can make your 1 point estates worth 3 points at the end of the game each, rather than just 1. And there's a different tracker for every size of estate. The landscaper is another action. It is signified by a green trees and foliage. When you take the landscaper action in the same row that you placed your house, you get to check off the lowest number tree on the tree tracker. This is that tracker that's above park tracker. Yeah, this is the numbers that are above every row of houses. You get to check that off, and at the end of the game, you'll earn points.
It should be noted that the longest row of houses has the highest possible point value for the park track, but it also requires more landscapers to be played in that row.
So the last... Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, and then the smallest row of houses has the lowest amount of parks required, but it also has the lowest points at the highest level.
Okay, so the last action is pools. So if a pool action is tied to a number, if you place that number on a house that has a pool in its backyard, then you get to circle that pool to show that it has been built, and then check off the lowest number on the pool tracker, and this gives you a lot of bonus points at the end of the game. So just to recap where the points come from and how the game ends. So you earn points if you complete city plan card objectives, and if you manage to complete them first, you'll get more points. You get points from your parks if you put if you use the landscaper actions, and you get the lowest point value still showing on every row, which can go from 0 to up to 18 on the third row. You get points if you manage to place houses with the pool action on houses that have pools in their backyard. You get points if you have the most, second most, or third most temp actions taken. You get points for every completed estate, and you'll get bonus points if you use the real estate agent for different sizes of estate. And then you'll get penalties. You get penalized points, negative points for every biz action you took. And if you happened to end up not, if you happen to fail to place a house in any round, those can be negative points.
Oh.
And the way that the game ends is whether either the first time a player completes all three city plan cards, when all houses are filled in one player's suburb, or when one player fails to place three houses.
Right. I did want to mention one quick thing about the end game, which is that the estates, when you score them at the end of the game, they can be the same estates that you use for the city plans. That part doesn't matter. But they still have to be surrounded by fences and completed in ascending order. So if you have like a gap in your houses somewhere, none of those houses will be scored.
Right. Yeah. Estates only count if they're filled up. All houses have a number and they have a fence on either side. And like you said, you can't have an estate larger than 6. So if you even if you filled in your whole bottom row of 12 houses with numbers in ascending order, they won't score any points unless you subdivide them into estates that are at least 6 or smaller.
Does it not just give you the points for an estate size of 6?
No.
Oh. Okay.
No, you need to have exactly 6 houses or exactly fewer than 6 houses to score some amount of points. Okay, so that's how you play the game. Again, it's like a roll and write game, but instead of rolling, you're drawing cards from a deck. So let's talk strategy. on welcome to dot dot dot.
So I think the biggest thing is that you want to try and finish at least one permit before anybody else, or one city plan.
Right.
These give you, on average, 10 points if you complete it first. And if you don't, then you'll be missing out on like four of those. So
four to six. I've seen cards be like worth 11 points if you finished it first, and then like 4 or 5 points if you finished it later.
The big thing is that these are honestly not that hard to score. They mainly just require fences and then just placing your houses in a normal way. And you'll still score for the estates at the end of the game. So it's kind of like getting extra points for something you're already doing.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, it's like you want to be productive early on, even when there's like so much space to work with. And so that's why you'd want to go for these. It lets you play productively.
There's a first come, first serve element, and it's very helpful to get those couple extra points over your opponents by completing the city plan cards before they can.
Yeah.
I tend to shoot for the one that's worth the most points if you complete it first.
I think.
But there's also some merit to going after two city plan cards at the same time if there's some overlap in the size of the estates required.
Right. So, like, if you see two city plans that have a six estate, then you can focus on building that six estate first. And then from there, once you're done with that, you can see, like, somebody else might be close to finishing one of them, but not the other. Or you can just go for one quicker than the other.
You can assess the situation after you've completed the six, figure out which one you want to actually gun for to be the first to complete it.
Yeah, I think early on it's also worth looking for the city plan that has the fewest fences required, because that way you can spend your other early cards on either like biz, which might help you get the plan a little sooner, or you can focus on like parks or something that just gives you points.
Mm-hmm.
Pools especially are really hard to place in the late game, and so if you're able to fit those in while you're building your first plan, then that's a few more extra points.
I find that it's best to try and fit all of the estates for one plan on your first row, if at all possible, because that's going to lead to building the fewest fences total.
For sure.
Because the fences are already built on the edges, and there's likely not going to be any gaps in the row of 10.
Yeah.
I would just say maybe not exactly using the top row every time, but try to fit everything for a city plan on one row if you can.
Mm-hmm.
It may not come to be because maybe only low numbers are being drawn, but you can try to go for it.
Yeah.
I also like to say, by the way, if you ever see like a 1 or a 15 and you're not actively pursuing a city plan, or you are pursuing a city plan, but you haven't placed anything on the far end of one of your rows, like I find that picking up 1s and 15s are super useful.
Yeah. It's, you know, you want to make sure that your sort of middle range numbers can fit.
Mm-hmm.
And so giving yourself the largest possible range to work with is just so helpful. I think getting zeros and 16s or 17s is also super useful.
Sure.
For the same reason. It just lets you fill in houses much more comfortably.
Mm-hmm. So if you, if you are going for city plans that have overlapping effects, like we said, you can't use the same estate for both city plans. It's the flexibility that really matters here. Also, if you are going for city plans that have the same sizes of estates, then that makes your real estate agent actions much more valuable, because you're more likely to make multiples of a certain size of estate, and the real estate agent will increase the point value of that size of estate.
Yes, the number of times you're getting the real estate action is limited, and so you'll probably be able to max out 2, 1.5 maybe tracks for that. So, like, two different sizes of estates. And so finding the overlap there, like you said, helps a lot, because it means you can maximize the points you're getting from real estate. Especially because in every row, the bottom, or every type of estate, the bottommost number is a larger jump than, like, the first to second or second to third number.
Well, actually, that's not entirely true.
Oh, really?
So the 3 and 4 real estate trackers, the largest number, it only increases by 1 every time you take the real estate agent, even for the last number. So I'll say this about it, and this seems like kind of a bit of balance baked into the game, but if you're it's risky to go for 6 because it's hard to finish more than 1 or 2 6 estates city. Like I went for 6s. I increased my 6 tracker all the way with real estate actions the last time we played, and I was 1 house away at the end of the game from finishing a 3rd 6, which would have really put me in the lead. But because I wasn't able to finish it, because 6s are very difficult to finish, then I ended up getting like 4th place in the game that we played. So 6s are risky. 5s are a little less risky. Definitely worth going for, especially if you plan to make more than 2 5 estates because of city plans. 3s and 4s, if you invest in them, the payoff isn't as good at the end, but at least 3 only has 3 spaces that you need to fill. 4 has 4 spaces, and then 5 and 6 also have 4 spaces you need to fill before they're maxed out. 1 and 2 have the lowest values, but they do have a big jump at the end, where 1 goes from being worth 1 point to being 3 points each, and 2 goes from 2 to 3 to 4. Actually, hold on. How does 2 really end up at... Does 2 really end up at 4? 2, 3, 4? Yeah, okay. Actually, 2 doesn't increase by 2 at the end of its tracker. It only goes up by 1 each time. Okay. But it only takes 2. So you can feasibly max out 1, 2, and maybe 6 or 5 or something like that.
I definitely think 6 and 1 is very manageable and useful. It's easy to wind up with like very small estates next to your big ones, especially because a lot of city plans that use 6s also require 1s or 2s.
Sure. I would say it's generally when you look at the 3 city plan cards, there's going to be a couple large numbers that appear on multiple cards. And then there's probably going to be one card that has multiple small numbers. So there's one might require 2 2s or one might require 3 1s. So it helps to just max those out because you're probably going to make that many small estates anyways.
Right.
Although too many small estates can be a little bit of an investment because you have to get a lot of fences for that.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind.
So I want to mention that pools on average give you about 3.5 points. It starts at like an increase of 3 and then it goes to an increase of 4 and then an increase of 5, I believe. But the like pools are very specific in how you place them. Also, I think the temp agency doesn't give you many points, so it's not worth focusing on it. Instead, just like treating it as a bonus, and the real benefit is the flexibility with the number.
Right. So I want to talk about degrees of freedom and how you should use this to place your numbers.
Yes.
Early in the game.
Sound like a Sudoku channel.
Sure. I mean, it is sort of a concept used in Sudoku, but the idea is, so take example, the bottom row of 12. When you place any number in there, you are limiting your degrees of freedom depending on where it is. If you put a 2 on the second house from the left, then you have, like, what is it, 13 degrees of freedom on the right? Because you can still put 3 to 15 in there.
That's not 13, that's 2.
It's 12?
Three degrees.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, 3 degrees of freedom. You have 3 degrees of freedom on your right, but you only have 1. You have no degrees of freedom on your left. You have to put a 1 there. Technically, I guess you could put a 0 if you had a temp, but that's hard to come across.
Yeah.
So you basically only have 0 degrees of freedom to your left, but 3 to your right. So, you know, putting a 2 here is good for the houses to your right, bad for the houses to your left. It's probably better just to put the 2 on the far left end of the 12 row. You still have 2 degrees of freedom on your right, and you no longer are searching for a very specific number. So placing your numbers in places where you'll get a balanced amount of degrees of freedom on either side of them, I think, is key to keeping things flexible in this game. And then later on, it's nice when you can put a car or put a number in that maintains how many degrees of freedom you established earlier. So if you put a 2 on the far left row of your third row, which has 12 spaces, you have 2 degrees of freedom. But if you could get a 3 and you put it next to that 2, you still are maintaining that 2 degrees of freedom.
Yeah. I think in general, 2 to 3 degrees is the sweet spot. It's hard to get more than 2 degrees in the bottom row. But trying to maintain that amount when you like place gaps between numbers is pretty important.
Mm-hmm. So another thing to keep in mind with this situation is that the closer a number is to the center of the distribution, the more often it appears. So when you're placing a 7, you know, you could think to put it where the degrees of freedom are the same on either side of it, except there's more 8s in the game than there are 6s. So you can count on an 8 showing up a little more often than a 6. So you can be a little looser on the left side with degrees of freedom and a little stricter on the right side, the ascending side of the 7, because you're more likely to get that 8, so you don't have to worry so much about the degrees of freedom to the right.
Yeah.
You can be more restricted over there.
Mm-hmm. I do also want to mention that the biz, the penalty you get is kind of similar to the rate that the pools increase. And so you kind of want your biz, if you use one, to give you more than 3 or 4 points. So, for example, if you use a biz to complete one of the city plans first, then you're getting about 5 points and losing 3 points. So you've net points in the end. You have a net gain.
For another rule of thumb, you could think like it helps if your biz accomplishes multiple things. Like yeah. It finishes a city plan card and it finishes it first compared to other players. It finishes it in a state, and it finishes in a state that you plan to have multiple of, which means you plan to invest real estate agent actions into it.
Exactly.
I think one last point that I want to make is that you can't really plan for the end of the game. It'll kind of sneak up on you, whether it's the all three objectives or whether it's somebody just being unable to place their houses, or if it's just someone fill. Well, I guess when it comes to someone filling up their whole board, that one is probably the least often one, and it takes a really long time for that to happen. And it's surprising that if that happens before the three objectives happened, it's because they put a ton of extra fences that maybe they probably shouldn't. But anyways, you can't really plan for the end of the game, whatever it is. So just always be shooting for like the quickest way to get points when it comes to the end game. Don't plan for a big payoff because you might not hit it. Like you might not be able to finish that third city plan card. Maybe you should just segment your estates into smaller ones so that you can actually score them.
Right. My last point is to pay attention to the upcoming actions. Since you can see which actions are coming up next, this is especially relevant for biz and fences, because those are what you need to complete estates. And so you can kind of look at what's there, think like, this one could give me a fence now, but this other number could give me some extra points for like a park, and there's a fence coming up next, so I can still get the fence next turn.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So that's it for our strategy discussion. Let's take a short break to talk about plugs.
Mm-hmm.
All right, plugs time. You can follow us on social media, on Facebook and Twitter at BG Bros Cast. You can hit us up with suggestions for games that you'd like to hear us talk about there. You can also go to our website, bgbcast.com. We have a form there. If you want to hit us up with your suggestion with that form, feel free to do so. And we also have all of our episodes cataloged and organized on our website, bgbcast.com. You can use our nifty search bar function to find episodes where we discuss certain topics or games that you want to hear our thoughts on. You can also find a link to our TeePublic store via our website. That's teepublic.com/users/bgbcast, where you can get merch with our cool new logo on it. And that basically does it for BG Bros plugs. So let's hear from Matt plugs.
I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That's twitch.tv/twak. I stream on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday at about 1 p.m. Central Time. I play a lot of roguelites, especially a lot of roguelites recently. Some competitive games. I've recently been doing Hitman on Fridays, and I've also recently been doing something called The Unpack, which is a weekly segment where I kind of talk about whatever concept comes to mind. I've done episodes on roguelike design and Sonic level design. So if that interests you, check out that. You can also see a Discord server through there that you can get updates on when I go live and chat with other fans. You can also follow me on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming, where I tweet about things I'm working on or whatever I'm thinking about. And you can also check out my other podcast, NetSurfer Pro, a whirlwind ride through the World Wide Web, where me and my co-host Galen talk about interesting media, mainly from the 21st century. And that's on any podcasting platform, NetSurfer Pro.
All right. And if you'd like, you can follow me on Twitch at twitch.tv/radicalhawks. That's twitch.tv/radicalhawkz, where I mostly play Skate 2 while I wait for the release of Skate 4. And you can also find me on Twitter at Jeff Craig Designs. Let's get back to our discussion on video game design. Video game design. I meant board game design.
Yeah.
Board game design. Okay. So we're talking about the design of Welcome To.
Yes.
So I think what we can make the comparison really quick that this is a lot like another roll and write or draw and write game that we played recently, which was Cartographers.
Yeah, can I just point out that of the three roll and write games we've covered, two of them have had no rolling. I think that's fun.
I mean, it's interesting that it's just the name that we associate with this kind of game, because that's what it used to be almost entirely. But anyways, so we're playing these draw and write, roll and write, whatever games. We've talked about them before. This bears a lot of similarities to Cartographers because it uses a deck. However, one of the big things that differentiate this to Cartographers is that the way that the deck is used, how you shuffle it a great deal. There's a large number of cards in the game, and how they line up with, you know, the numbers and actions is going to be vastly different from game to game. So you really can't rely on the same kind of familiarity with the game that you could in Cartographers for this game. There's a lot more, you could say, improvisation.
Variance.
I like to think variance. There's definitely more variance. I like to think that what that leads to is just more like math and like optimal play rather than like skilled understanding of the game kind of play. Does that make sense?
Well, so it's a different kind of skill. I think most roll and write games have a setup where early game there's a lot of freedom with how you place whatever you're given, but late game you start to get really squeezed and compromised and like it becomes harder to place. And I think what keeps this from being purely optimal is that you kind of know that your choices are going to cascade later. So it's very hard to say, like, you know, this is going to be the correct decision. Mm-hmm. I think especially because of the way the numbers work in this game makes that harder than Cartographers.
Sure.
Where, like, because you don't know if placing a 14 on the farthest right side will be good enough because there could have been a 15 a bit later, especially if you haven't drawn any 15s yet.
This game is a little more punishing. In Cartographers, when you can't place something, you still get to place like a little one square region in your player board. In this game, if you can't place anything, then you have to potentially take negative points or just lose the game by ending it and having a 5-point penalty applied to your score.
Yeah, but
which
I think
significant.
I think it becomes a lot harder to know what the optimal play is. And so it might not necessarily be math that's like the skill that helps you figure out what's decent, but there's definitely a lot of weighing risks in sort of a different way than other games.
I do enjoy how the tension gets ratcheted up more because of these elements in this game. There's a lot more tension in this game compared to Cartographers, also because like the point value cards are first come first serve, similar to like Food Chain Magnet, so there's a tension to try to get there faster before everybody else, and then there's the tension towards the end of the game where you really need like a specific number, you need like a high number or a low number to show up in the next batch of cards, and there's a chance that all three are high, all three are low, or all three are somewhere in the middle and are unusable to you. And if you like that kind of tension in a game, then that's good. We can abandon the comparison and just talk about this game now.
Sure. Yeah. I do like the way the double-sided cards are used. Mm-hmm. It double-sided cards are still kind of a rarity in games, it feels like. In this case, it's used to make a really like elegant system for turns. So like you create these pairs of actions and numbers literally just by flipping over the card and revealing the next card. So it's very quick, very elegant, very, I would say, easy to set up.
Oh yeah, pretty easy
to
set up. You
just shuffle and deal into three decks.
Yeah, you just got to be good at shuffling a lot of cards at once. And that's the only, like, difficulty with setting up. Everything right. else is, yeah, you just deal them into three decks and you're done.
But, like, what this adds is a ton of variety between games in a lot of subtle ways, even. Because, like, the pools on the score sheet are static. They're always the same for each score sheet. But the pools in the deck are different every time because you don't know what they'll be paired up with.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with, like, the temp agencies. You know, we mentioned that it's possible to get a 0 or a 17, but it might never come up that way in any given game. And I think that's where the benefit of this game's, like, replayability is. You kind of, it's up to you to notice these synergies when they happen.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think that adds a fun little bit of, like, ooh, this is a game where this was possible.
Oh, by the way, I don't recall this being a rule in the rule book, but I watched a how to play video for this game, and I saw that it's an option that once a player finishes a city plan card for the first time, that player can choose to have the decks shuffled and redealt.
Oh, that is a rule in the rule book.
Okay, cool. That's one. We didn't mention that in our how to play guide, and I think that's a rule that we kind of ignore and forget about when we play this game.
Mm-hmm.
But that addition of that rule helps. In some ways, it helps to make it so that, like, if the 15s got drawn early on, they could come back around much sooner, or they will come back around. But on the other hand, it makes it less important for you to pay attention to the kinds of cards that are being dealt out every round, so that you can guess, like, because it shows you how many 8s and 7s and 6s there are, you could be like, oh, I've seen 2 6s already. There's probably not going to be another 6 for a really long time. You know, if you're shuffling the deck at 2 periods throughout the game, in addition to whenever the decks run out, then it's harder and less important to do that sort of thing, which mm-hmm. takes less of the skill away, but introduces more of the variance.
Yeah. I think what's really interesting about, like, telling the player how many of each card there is that it almost encourages counting cards. Like, just by the fact that you bring to the player's attention that there's only 2 15s in the deck means that when the first one comes up, it's more likely that the player will think there's only 1 15 left. And mm-hmm. then they can, like, remember that. Even if they're not, like, consciously trying to count cards, the fact that it's pretty visible how many cards there are means that, like, those outliers kind of contribute to the game sense.
Mm-hmm. I think it's for me, it's less important that I can count the cards and they've given me the counts, and more important that I can just use that knowledge to make safe assumptions.
Exactly.
Like, if 15 shows up, I know, oh, I should use it because it's not likely to come back again, and it makes a very safe number to put on the far end of one of my rows.
Exactly. But, like, imagine if they only showed that card count in the rule book, or if they never sure. did, then it'd be a lot less likely that any given player will think 1 15 showed up, or, you know, a 13 showed up, so I'm less likely to get that.
Yeah, or you might think, if you didn't know that information, you might see a 13 and be like, well, there's only 2 numbers higher than 13. I should just put it all the way on the right. Or, you know, or there's still 2 numbers higher than 13. Maybe I leave a space for them, even though it's really unlikely that they come up. If you don't know that it's really unlikely that they'll come up, then you might not leave that space. In fact, it's probably more optimal to put the 13 all the way in the end in at least your first or second row.
Right. The way the row sizes work is pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's interesting because, for one thing, the prominent use of sixes in the city plans works really well with the row sizes, especially because one fence can divide the bottom row into 2 6s.
Mm-hmm.
I think the fact that they're, like, there's a small, medium, and large, to me at least, it really does come up in gameplay, even though there's a very small difference between their sizes. And I think, like, the fact that the bottom one is harder to fill in completely because it has less degrees of freedom, but it has that higher park reward, like, all of that's very tied in together really well, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then the top row having the lesser reward, but it has much more degrees of freedom, but it's also a little worse at filling in some estate or some city plans. Like, I think it's well balanced to also, like, provide the player some amount of safety. It's still going to fill up by the end of the game, but early game, you can be like, you know, oh, I want to have my top row open a bit more because that way I can dump numbers that otherwise can't go anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it comes out naturally in the gameplay pretty frequently, that feeling of like one of them safe, there's a hard one, there's the medium one.
Well, I think that also organized. By chance, I end up putting my smaller estates on the top row in the smallest row and my medium sized estates in the middle row and the larger estates in the larger row. I guess in one regard, like it's just easier to do that because if I put in a six in the top row, then that limits the number of smaller estates or other estates I can pair with it. So it's better to put the six in the rows where there's room for other stuff.
I think
it's just interesting that things just kind of get delegated like that.
I think the fact that the bottom row has so few degrees of freedom kind of gives me a tendency to build upward with like, okay, I need to get this bottom part figured out first. Mm-hmm. So the moment I draw one, it immediately goes into the bottom row or two.
Even. Yeah. It makes me want to build as tightly as I can, leaving no degrees of freedom, or not leaving no degrees of freedom, but maintaining a steady amount of degrees of freedom as I place numbers. Like if I draw an eight and I already have a nine placed, I want to put it right next to that nine in that third row.
Also, every fifth house in each row has a red roof, so it makes it easier to divide it on a fly.
Mm.
Like I feel like it would be harder on at a quick glance to be like, I need to put a fence here in the row if it wasn't for the fact that there are these like markers between them.
Yeah, I enjoy the sort of nature of every point tracker being like if you invest in it, it has a big payoff. So that like after you get past the city planning, there is a little bit of player expression. There doesn't feel like there's as much player expression in this game than in other Roll and Write games. But where there is that like the payoffs are usually big enough to warrant focusing on them.
Mm-hmm.
Such as pools or parks or six estates size six.
Mm-hmm. That had a nice rhythm to it. I do also want to say something about the player aid in this game.
Mm-hmm.
So the player aid has the card counts, like we said. It has the ways the game can end, but then it also has the descriptions for each action. But also it has an example of how that looks on the like sheet, the score sheet. So like it'll show the biz and it's like copy any house you have and put it next to that same house. And then it points to a section where it has an eight and then an eight with a B on it. Or like the fence is like build a fence anywhere. And it points to a part where somebody drew in a fence.
Yeah. And it manages to do all this on a single row of houses. Like it's kind of cool. Yeah. That they like demonstrate every effect very succinctly in one row of houses. Like they show every effect in those houses pretty easily.
Yeah, it's like a lot of player aids don't have the space to do that. I think it's definitely helped that there's only really six different effects and how they function.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that also helps a lot for new players to be like, oh, hey, I just look here. That's what it looks like.
Talking about successful layout design, looking at the player's scorecard and the bottom portion of a player's sheet, everything is laid out very well. So there's the distinct sections for the different ways to score or lose points, you know, the objectives, parks, pools, temp agency, real estate agents, biz, and then failing to place houses. They're organized very neatly. They have the illustrations from the cards in the areas with the relevant point scoring trackers, so you know that like you put your park points here and your pool points here and you check these off for your temps, and this is where you check off for real estate because all those symbols from the cards exist down here as well. But they have this sort of like flow chart layout on top of this. Also, by the way, not only that, the city plan card points, which is one of the important things, the ways that you end the game, is on the far left side. And the failing to place houses, the second thing that can end the game, is on the far right side. So they keep the end game goal things on the ends, so they're easy to look at. Anyways, it's like a flowchart where each of these trackers has beneath them a space to put your total points that you've earned. And those spaces are all lined up in a row to make this nice just addition equation for you. Usually, like with Between Two Castles, for example. These things are like aligned 90 degrees from this, where you have to align things up in a vertical column. But that they're all in a row is a little different, and I find to be a little bit easier to manage.
It gives
and
you it's space just all very to do well math.
It gives you space to do math.
It also, and under each
like
of
I the... said, the end conditions are on either side of this thing, so it's nice that they keep those on the edges.
Right. Under each of the estate columns, it also gives you space to write the like multiplier for how many estates you have. So it's like, you know, estate size one, how many points it's worth, then it has X, dot, dot, dot. And then underneath that's the bubble where you put in the points you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very straightforward. It has a good flow of like choosing which action pair you want, writing it in the houses, and then going down to mark whatever scoring thing you got, whether it's pool or temp or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. I have a point about interesting situations where you have to trade safety for a bigger payoff. I guess this is sort of a continuation of like, I mentioned there's that rising tension when your board's filling up and you're finding that you have less and less spaces where you can place houses and your degrees of freedom are being restricted. But there come situations where you're like, this number is the number I need to put. I have a 7 and a 9 and I need to put an 8 between them, and there's an 8 right there. But I've been investing in pools and I can place that 13 on a pool house, and that'll take me from 17 to 21 points. And those situations are interesting. Making players make interesting decisions like that is very cool. And it's nice that those decisions will be different for different players in any given game, because there's enough variance for this kind of game.
Yeah.
And then the last point I had to make was on the illustrations. But you can make your smaller point if you'd like.
So my last point that I wanted to make was that I love that the game's title is just Welcome To. Because on the score sheet, there is a place to put your city's name.
Mm.
And so it's fitting that they don't have, like, a title for the name in the game. But the game is, like, a prompt. Like, mm-hmm. like the game is preparing you for making your own city and putting your own city in there.
Yeah.
It's like your name.
It's very
here.
Clever. It's a very clever game naming. It sort of evokes the creativity that you need to create your own individual city.
Yeah.
Welcome to the city that you plan to make.
Coolsville.
I just wanted to touch on the illustration for this game. So this game is set in the 50s, you know, in the in-universe description of this game, the flavor of this game. It's in the 50s when there was like the big suburbia boom.
The baby.
And there was a lot of suburban construction.
Literal boomer game.
It's a literal boomer game. And so they use illustration styles that evoke that time period very fittingly. They also the same sort of illustration style used in something like Monopoly or Food Chain Magnet, except for the actual neighborhoods themselves, and I guess also the like the numbers, which on the cards are like addresses on the front of houses. They're like address plates, which is also very fitting because you have to put them in ascending order. But the illustration is much more detailed than something from the games that I described who use a similar art style, which I think helps a lot to visualize everything in this game. Like, if you could imagine this game, except all the houses were just like boxes in a row, and the pools were just like ovals behind them, I feel like it would be a lot harder to visualize putting the numbers in rows and breaking them into sections of 6 and 5 and 4 and 3 and 2 and 1. Just that like extra 3D element, not really 3D, but that extra spatial element comes through much more when you're picturing an actual place and you can see an actual place beneath you in this bird's eye view. So I appreciate that about this game. I think some games benefit, like Wavelength, from having less illustration and being much more graphic design forward. This game benefits from having the illustration where it counts. Everywhere else is pretty simple illustrations, like the symbols for each action are kind of basic vector artwork. The scoreboard is kept pretty simple. All of the circles and boxes that you check off are just like simple rounded circles and boxes inside light blue or red fields, whether they earn you points or lose you points. It's kept very clean just to keep the focus on the main illustration, which is your rows of houses.
Mm-hmm. I didn't even like catch the connection between putting numbers on houses and like address numbers.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I mean, the, on the cards, I'm surprised you didn't, because that's what they show on the cards themselves, like the deck of cards you draw from. The numbers are like addresses on the front of houses.
Yeah, I never noticed that.
So the theming is very good. It ties very well to the visuals they chose, and the visuals in the way that they use them are very successful. So all in all, excellent graphic and visual design for this game, in my opinion. Do you have any final thoughts?
Not really. Other than that, there are like ads for other, the backs of the player helpers have ads for their other games.
I was going to mention that.
In that like 1950s style.
Well, are they for their other games? Because I thought they were just like joke ads.
Are
like,
they? I don't know. Maybe they are just joke ads.
I think they mostly referenced the name of their company, which is the publishing company, which is Blue Cocker Spaniel, or Blue Cocker Studios, based on Blue Cocker Spaniel. So they had a lot of ads, like movie posters and like adopt a blue Cocker Spaniel today and stuff like that on the back of the player aids, which are very well done in the style of 1950s advertisements,
sort of,
like Mad Men.
Sort of a Rockwell-ish type of style.
Maybe, yeah. Definitely very, very Mad Men, Ad Men type advertisements, hand illustrated and such. So yeah, visuals on point for this game. And it's pretty replayable. It's pretty fun. It's fun to solve and work with. It leads to some interesting situations. I recommend it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So for that ends our discussion on Welcome To... Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
We'll see you next time.